Life is funny when you look backwards, isn't it? When you look forwards, life gets kind of scary. You don't know where you're going to be in a year, 10 years, however many years. But when you look backwards, you kind of see how some things add up and you say, okay, I see why that happened or why that happened. I'll give you one example. I remember my sophomore year in college, so that was more years than I'm willing to admit now ago, but I was studying engineering, and after sophomore year, typically what you did was start in the internship circuit, and so I did everything with the College of Engineering to sign up, to give them my resume, my grades, stuff like that, and they had us put it on a 3.5-inch disc for you young kids. This is before the internet, so we had to put it on something that went into a computer. Never mind. So we put it on a disc and we'd have to turn that in at the office. And I remember months went by and I heard nothing. No phone calls. My friends were getting these great internships, were really excited about it and at neat companies there around in the Columbus area. And I heard nothing. And I'm thinking, man, I don't think my grades were that bad. But so I went to the office there and said, hey, just wanted to know, why am I not getting any offers, any phone calls even? And so they said, well, let's look you up. And they brought me up on the computer and only to discover I wasn't even in there. And I said, well, I turned my data disk in and they turned around to the file and they said, no, we have no record of you ever turning anything in. And it was interesting that summer then, since it was too late to get an internship, I ended up going on a mission trip. And on that mission trip, I surrendered to the ministry. I met a really good friend who ended up getting me a job at the church where I ultimately met my wife. And so I think had some employee actually put that disc where they were supposed to put that disc, my kids don't exist. Doesn't that just blow your mind? I mean, so looking backwards in life, you can see, oh, that was so frustrating. I was so frustrated then. But looking backwards, just a trivial example like that, you get it. It falls into place. You understand how God used it. And so for you, maybe that was a medical situation. Maybe it was a financial one. Maybe it was a relationship. But now looking backwards, you see how God has used it for good. We're going to continue to see that in the book of Esther today as we turn into chapter 4. We've been in the series for a while. I'll catch you up in case you've been with us. So I need somebody with a deep voice to say previously in Esther. And then we learn about these Jewish people who were in captivity, who were then taken to Persia, and then they were set free. But then they decided, some of them, not to go home. And so we're following a family that was like that. They decided not to go back to Jerusalem. There were Jewish people remaining in Persia, which is modern-day Iran. We meet Xerxes, who is an incredibly powerful king, the leader of the Persian Empire, which was an incredible world power at that time. Xerxes was throwing a party, and he wanted to show off his beautiful wife Vashti. She refused, and so he had her banished. His advisors had an idea that we recommend kidnapping young women from around the kingdom and deciding which one brings you the most pleasure and she'll be your new king. And so he said, that sounds like a good plan to me. And so he carried it out. And that's when we meet a young lady named Esther. She's a young Jewish orphan being raised by her cousin named Mordecai. She's taken from her home. She's prepared for a year, and ultimately she finds favor with the king. And against all odds, this young Jewish woman becomes queen of the Persian Empire. Meanwhile, her cousin Mordecai had a job as a palace guard, and he uncovered a plot to assassinate King Xerxes. He relayed this information to his cousin Esther, who's now the queen, and Mordecai's story was found to be true. The two men plotting against the king to assassinate the king were impaled on poles, and Mordecai's name got added to the history books, and he was credited as saving the king, but he never received any reward or recognition at that time for it. Fast forward, we're introduced to another character in the story that's going to be very important. His name is Haman. Haman was ultimately promoted to the chief of the nobles. So basically, he's the most powerful man in all of the Persian Empire, except for Xerxes himself. Well, everybody thought he was so powerful that they'd actually bow to him as he entered their presence. As he'd walk through the palace, all the servants, all the guards would regularly bow to him, curtsy to him, to show respect. Except for one guy, Mordecai refused to bow to him. It wasn't a religious reason. He just said, no, I'm not bowing to you. You're no different than me. And so Haman finds out that Mordecai is Jewish, and Haman comes up with a fantastic plan to get back at him. Basically, let's get back at Mordecai for not bowing at me or to me by killing all of the Jews, by exterminating every single Jewish person in the entire Persian Empire. And so Haman takes this plan to King Xerxes, and Xerxes goes, yeah, okay, sounds good. So at that point, it was scheduled that the following March, everybody in the Persian Empire would kill their Jewish neighbors, men, women, children, and if you were the one to kill them, then you got to keep their stuff. Needless to say, it was a bleak time for the Jewish people. That's where we pick up the story today in Esther chapter 4. Let's say a word of prayer, and then we'll read what happens next. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for bringing us here today. Thank you for this time of worship. May we take a deep breath and humble our hearts now and prepare ourselves to be changed by you and your word. As we read through this book of Esther where you're not mentioned, we know you're at work. We know that your providence is there in this book. We know that you're working behind the scenes in our lives as well. And so God, as we see a little bit more of that today, I pray that you would teach us and that you would change us. Calls us to act differently when we leave here as a result of learning from your word today. It's in Jesus' name we pray, and amen. So it was April. It was spring of that year. In March the following year, the Jewish people were scheduled to be exterminated by their neighbors throughout the Persian Empire. Whoever killed a family got to keep their stuff. It was a bleak time for the Jewish people, and honestly, other people in the Persian Empire too. That doesn't really sound that fun to do. You're looking at your neighbor and you're thinking, I don't want to do this, but by law, I have to. So bleak time for the Jewish people, to say the least. In chapter 4, we see Mordecai's reaction upon hearing the king's decree. Read it with me in verse 1. When Mordecai learned about all that had been done, he tore his clothes, he put on burlap and ashes, and he went out into the city, crying with a loud and bitter wail. He went as far as the gate of the palace, for no one was allowed to enter the palace gate while wearing clothes of mourning. And as news of the king's decree reached all the provinces, there was a great mourning among the Jews. They fasted, wept, and wailed, and many people lay in burlap and ashes. Very sad situation indeed, and Mordecai is responding how we would expect somebody to respond. This is quite different. You remember the last verse we read at the end of last week, the reaction of Xerxes and Haman? Let's go back and look at that last verse in chapter 3, verse 15. The second part says this, "Then the king," that's Xerxes, "and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa fell into confusion." And so Xerxes makes this proclamation that all these Jews are to be killed. And him and Haman go to the palace and they have a drink. Meanwhile, the city's turned to confusion and you see Mordecai's reaction here. I think this contrast, these two verses are next to each other on purpose. The juxtaposition of the two shows just how out of touch Xerxes is inside his palace from what's actually happening with the people. You see how evil this man was in that he just seems to have simply shrugged and said, okay, yeah, sure, go ahead and wipe out a race of people just because of what Haman said and what Haman promised to pay. Let me do a quick aside here. So this is free. This is not one of my main points in this story, but it's very important. Be careful who you associate with and who you have around you. Xerxes' advisors from the beginning of the book have given him nothing but bad advice. Be careful who you associate with. I want to especially highlight that for those of you on social media who maybe get into something and you put something out there on Facebook or something else. You know what? Somebody out there is going to agree with you and your bad plan. They're going to. Be careful who you take advice from, who you associate with. That's part of Xerxes' problem here. He surrounded himself with a bunch of idiots, and now Haman has come with this plan. Anyway, that was free. More important to this part of the story is Mordecai's response. He mourns in the tradition of the day. He's wearing burlap clothing. against his skin would be incredibly rough. This was a tradition in Old Testament times that they do that basically so that every single move they made, their physical pain would match their emotional pain. It was a reminder of their distress and their depression. And it showed everybody else that he was in mourning. Basically, he declared his state to be hopeless. Imagine how he felt specifically, because he wouldn't bow to Haman. Now the Jewish people were scheduled to be annihilated because he just wouldn't say, "Your Honor, Haman." I mean, it wasn't a religious type thing that he objected to. He just didn't want to do it. And so now as a result, Haman has orchestrated this incredible, terrible decree. Mordecai feels helpless and lost along with all the other Jews in the kingdom. Meanwhile, back in the palace, verse 4, when Queen Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was deeply distressed. She sent clothing to him to replace the burlap, but he refused it. Then Esther sent for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed as her attendant. She ordered him to go to Mordecai and find out what was troubling him and why he was in mourning. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the square in the front of the palace gate. And so this was probably 4 or 5 years after Esther had been removed from her home, taken to the palace, and had ultimately become queen. Apparently, her and Mordecai still don't get to talk. She's separated from her cousin Mordecai. They can't talk, and so she keeps up with him through her attendants. Word came to her that Mordecai was in burlap, so she sent him basically royal clothing, saying, "Hey, these would be more comfortable. Wear these." But he refused, so she figured out something must be wrong. Somehow, Esther had not yet heard what was happening in the kingdom. She hadn't heard that her people were about to be exterminated. Again, showing that the palace was pretty far removed from her daily life in the palace. So she sends Hathach back with to find out what was happening. Mordecai says in Esther chapter 4, back to Hathach, tells him the whole story, including the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai gave Hathach a copy of the decree that had been issued in Susa that called for the death of all the Jews. He asked Hathach to show it to Esther and explain the situation to her. He also asked Hathach to direct her to go to the king, to beg for mercy, and to plead for her people. So Hathach returned to Esther with Mordecai's message. And so Mordecai tells Hathach the entire story here of what is happening, and he gives him a copy of the royal decree to take back to Esther. And then Mordecai apparently has this great idea out of nowhere. Esther could do something about this. Esther is in the position that she could go and talk to the king on behalf of her people. And so Mordecai tells Esther that she should go to the king and plead for mercy on behalf of the Jewish people. Well, Esther, not surprisingly, is quite reluctant. Let's pick up the story in verse 10. Then Esther told Hathach to go back and relay this message to Mordecai. All the king's officials and even people in the provinces know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless the king holds out his gold scepter. And the king has not called for me to come to him for 30 days. So Hathach gave Esther's message to Mordecai. And so Esther basically says, one does not simply walk into Xerxes and say, "This is what I want." She has to remind Mordecai that you just don't go to the king and say, "Hey, I've got something to talk about, honey." That's not how their relationship worked. He had to call for you, and he hadn't called for Esther in a month. Apparently, this was a well-known policy of the Persian kings. You go back to the Greek historian Herodotus, and he even writes about this. To get an audience before a Persian king, you had to go through one of his attendants, and then the king invited you to come if he wanted you to come. If you showed up unannounced, the king had one simple motion. He held his gold scepter, and if he dipped it like this, you were okay. If he didn't, that was the guard's cue to go ahead and kill you right there on the spot. No questions asked, no ask who are you here, or why are you here, who are you, what do you want to talk about. It was just a lack of dipping that gold scepter down. It was the cue for those guards to execute that individual right away. So understandably, Esther was a little bit nervous, wasn't she? It's like he hasn't wanted me in a month, he hasn't called for me to come to, and I just don't want to just show up unannounced because everybody knows what could happen to me. And so she has Hathach relay this message back to Mordecai, but her cousin doesn't back down from this idea. Look at verse 13. Mordecai sent this reply back to Esther. Don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace, you will escape when all the other Jews are killed. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen for just such a time as this? Quite possibly these are the most well-known words in the book of Esther. For such a time as this, Mordecai is saying to Esther, everything that's happened to you. And so catch what he's saying here. Mordecai is actually making the proposition that Esther went through everything that she's gone through so that it could now be used for good. Now, we're familiar with this idea. We've been talking about it. Most of you are familiar with this story. But think of that just as a proposition on its own, that everything you've been through in your life now brings you to a place where God can use you for good. It's an amazing thing to think about. All of those seemingly random events in Esther's life, even the pain that was caused by losing her parents, becoming an orphan. We don't hear about that story, but that must have caused her some pain. How about the evil that had been done to her by taking her from her home? Mordecai is actually making the case that God is going to use it for such a time as this. You say, but Mordecai doesn't say anything about God, does he? In fact, in this part of Esther, more than anything else, you expect God to be talked about here. But as we talked about a couple weeks ago, God isn't even mentioned in the book of Esther. And yet here you think it has to come up. More than any other passage, you expect to see God mentioned here. And it seems to be evidence that the writer, the author of the book of Esther, actually left God out of it on purpose to show us that sometimes God is working even when we don't know that he is. Mordecai is not talking about random events. He says deliverance will come from somewhere else. Where did he mean? He meant from God. God would honor this covenant that he had with his people, that they would be protected no matter what Esther decided to do. But then he says, you were made queen for such a time as this. Who made Esther queen? Xerxes did, right? But yet when we look deeper, the case that Mordecai is saying is that Xerxes isn't the one that made you king. These events have not been orchestrated by men. It's God at work. That's what we've been calling providence. The fact that God is at work even though we can't see him at work. All of it had been for a purpose. And Mordecai says has led to this moment. And Esther, you need to act on it. And go to the king on behalf of your people. We don't really know if this was just a warning for Mordecai or if it was kind of a threat that he would reveal her identity if she didn't say something. We're not sure. Either way, Esther understands that now she has no choice. It's amazing, things switch in the book now. Up until this point, Esther has followed orders, has done what everybody has told her to do. But at this moment, something switches. And now Esther is the one that starts directing these events. And people start doing what she says to do. She recognizes who she is and what she's been put there for. Let's look at her response back to Mordecai in verse 15. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, "Go and gather together all the Jews of Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will do the same. And then, though it is against the law, I will go in to see the king. If I must die, I must die." So Mordecai went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Again, Esther calls everybody to fast, and they fast. I would point out here, why would you fast for 3 days just to do it? What are they doing? They're crying out to God. God is not mentioned in this book, but it is clear what is happening here. They are fasting so that God would intervene and protect Esther as she goes into the king and give her favor once again so that she has the words to say. Esther has resigned herself to death and recognized that this really is the only way, that she's going to die one way or the other. She would have to face her fear and go to see the king unannounced. And in that moment, he would either talk with her by lowering that scepter and giving the cue to the guards that everything's okay, or he would say, no, I want nothing more to do with you. And she would be executed on the spot. She wanted some time to prepare. She asked for 3 days of fasting. So we're actually going to stop here too, and we'll have to wait and see what happens next week. Sorry. Gotta love a good cliffhanger, right? So what do we take from this story? I'm sorry, Christy. I know you wanted to hear the rest of it. What do we take from this story? We've had lots of ups and downs, lots of intrigue in Esther. It's certainly, I mean, there's lots of situations that aren't godly. People aren't acting. I mean, Mordecai isn't exactly somebody to emulate. I would argue neither is Esther. Notice she didn't exactly do the heroic thing. It wasn't until she recognized that there was really no other choice. She said, if I must die, I must die. I'm going to die one way or the other, so I might as well go and do this. And so what are we to take from this story? Three things. Number one, God is at work in my life, even when I don't see it, even in the bad stuff. That's just hard to admit in the present tense, isn't it? When we turn around and we look backwards down the corridor of time at our lives, we can see God working. But then when we turn and we go forward, it's like, there's no way out of my situation now. We get fearful and we get anxious. But God is at work in my life, even in my struggles, even in my pain. He will use it. We call that God's providence. God's hand is working all the time, even though we don't always see that. I believe there are, and some of you might disagree with me, but I believe there are circumstances in our lives that are completely meaningless and random. I do. I think there are certain decisions that you make that don't matter at all, whether you brush your teeth with Crest or Colgate. Yeah, there's just a litany of decisions that we make that don't really make a difference in eternity. And then there are things that happen to us, and there are decisions we make. There are circumstances in our lives that are meaningful and are purposeful and do matter for eternity. And here's the problem. It's impossible for me and you to tell the difference between the two. We don't know when those decisions, those events, those circumstances that are happening in our lives, is God working in his providence, and when it's just random type things. And so you know what we do? We treat every part of life as if God is at work in every minute of every day of our entire lives, that God's providence works in this way. Seemingly inconsequential events can make an incredible difference. The pain that is so difficult to move through, and the circumstances that don't seem like there's a way out of, can ultimately change the course of life for all kinds of people. God is at work in my life, even in the bad stuff. And so, my life changes when I recognize it's not really my life. My life changes when I recognize it's not my own. I think that's what happened in Esther. That's where we see this change. She starts to own her circumstances. She says, look, maybe I made some bad decisions. Maybe some of this stuff happened to me, but I have been put in a position for such a time as this. My life begins to change when I recognize I'm not always the one in control of it. I'm not saying you don't live your life. You're the one making decisions. You go out and you try to live a godly life, but recognize God is working behind the scenes. And when things don't work out for you, that might be because there's a purpose. My life changes when I recognize it's not my own. All of my plans, my job, my school, my relationships, they're all there for a reason. Let me give you a little bit of homework. I want you to think about this tonight while you're going to sleep. Why do you live where you live? Why do you work where you work? Why do you go to school where you go to school? Is that just random? Or have you been put there by a God who works behind the scenes? God's providence and your purpose are so tied together that you can't fight it and you can't separate those two things. And so maybe there's something you've been putting off doing, much like Esther had no desire to walk into the king unannounced, but it was her purpose. Maybe there's something that you've been putting off doing. Maybe it's confessing something. Maybe it's talking to somebody else. It's now time for you to recognize it's time. I've been put here. I've been put in this situation for such a time as this. Maybe it's a conversation with a family member, a neighbor. Maybe it's a decision that you need to make. Just know that God is providentially working in your life. And your life changes when you recognize that He is God and you are not. Maybe it's a job change. Maybe it's a school change. Maybe it's, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend. But I got a feeling you know. Third thing I want you to see is quite possibly the most important thing, is that the sacrifice has been made for me in Christ. This is what I mean by that. When we look at this story, we don't just see the story of a young girl who's been put into a very difficult place so that she could save many of her people. We see a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ. I want you to look at this story a little bit different. Instead, we naturally see ourselves in the place of the hero. We see ourselves in the story as Esther. But I want you to think of it differently now. I want you to view yourself as one of those thousands of households of Jewish people in the city of Susa or somewhere in the kingdom that had been given a sentence of death, not because of anything they had done, just because of who they were. They had no hope whatsoever. They looked forward to the next year with incredible anxiousness, wondering what steps can we take. There's nothing that we can do. I can't march in and talk to the king. I would be executed before I even got into the inner chamber. The guards would take me out. There is nothing I can do about my situation, but there is someone who stands in position to talk to the king on my behalf. Doesn't that sound like a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ? So imagine yourselves not necessarily in the position of Esther, but in a position of someone who is hopeless and has no right to live, no way to get past their impending doom unless one person goes and talks to the king for them. That person has talked to the king for you on your behalf, and that person is Jesus Christ. So today, our response to this sermon is not to say, I need to be more like Esther. It's to instead remember what Christ has done for us, to take communion together. As the band comes back up and the guys who will be serving communion come on up, and we